Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 17, delivered on March 23, 2016. The title of this lecture is Investment Decision Making Rules.
Today, Investment Decision Rules. I went through the two biggies, the net present value and the internal rate of return. Now, the one that you would want to use as a general rule would be the net present value rule. The reason I would encourage you to do that, to use the net present value rule, is because the internal rate of return rule has a mathematical oddity in it. If the cash flow from the project switches sign more than once, the internal rate of return will have multiple values. And none of them will actually really mean much of anything. So in other words, if you just go from negative cash flow at zero to positive cash flow after that, internal rate of return works fine. NPV works fine too. But if you were to say, start a project that had, well, let me do one over here. We have a cash outflow of $5,000. Then in the first year, you got $2,500. Then in the second year, you have negative $1,000. Then in the last year, you have, $4,500. Well, I won't worry about salvage values here. That would have more than one switch in sign. And so the internal rate of return method, depending on where you started to look for the internal rate of return, you might find it to be one number. But if you started searching for it another place, it might have another number. Now, remember, and I'm going to go back here now, and bring up something for you. Let me get the financial calculator up here. I'm not going to use it right away, but remember that the net present value declines as you use a higher and higher discount rate because you're using a larger number to discount future cash flows to the present. So the net present value has a profile that looks like this. If I were to choose a low discount rate, I'd get a net positive net present value project. But at a high enough rate to discount the future expected cash flows, I'd get a negative number. The crossing point from negative to positive net present value is what we call the internal rate of return. Now, if I were to ask you, what is the internal rate of return? The straight answer is, the simple answer is, the internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. That's all there is to it. Don't get complicated with it. Okay, the internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. That's what the internal rate of return is. It's a fine rule. It's okay to use it. Like, for example, and just to bring this up, if I were to use a discount rate of, let's say, 10% at, well, let me do this. At 8%, the net present value equals positive $365. But at 12%, the net present value equals negative $98.50. I would know that the internal rate of return was somewhere between 8 and 12%. Your financial calculators can do this just so fast. Back in the old days, literally, we would have to go back and forth. Okay, we tried 8%, we got a positive number. We tried 12%, we got a negative number. Okay, and then we would narrow it down. We'd keep going back and forth until we got a number that was 0 to 2 decimal places of percentage. It was a pain in the butt to do it that way, and these calculators can just zoom, 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 and get the answer really easily. Now, so the internal rate of return, and I'll do this one more time with you just to make sure you get the idea. Okay, I have given you the cash flows for a project, negative cash flow and then a stream of positive. For a project lasts 8 years. And I said, well, I'll come back to you tomorrow once the bean counters get me a discount rate. I'll come back and give you the discount rate to use to discount these. I want you to find the net present value. And I'll get that once they give me the number. Well, you could go ahead and get the internal rate of return for the project. And let's say you got an internal rate of return for the project of 13%. Okay, I want you to discount these. I come back tomorrow. I want you to discount these cash flows at 11%. You can immediately tell me whether to accept or reject. What do you tell me?
Reject.
No, you would accept. Because below the internal rate of return, the NPV is positive. Do you see that? If I give you any discount rate below that internal rate of return, it would be a positive net present value. Say yes. If I had given you I want you to use a discount rate of 16%, you would say, oh, I know right now I don't even have to calculate the net present value. I know it's going to be negative because the internal rate of return was 12% or whatever I told you it was. And so it's going to be negative. It's down in the negative territory by that time. See, when you use low discount rates, those cash flows out there in the future are going to be discounted lightly, so they will hit hard. But if you're using high discount rates, those outlying positive cash flows are going to be smacked hard, and so they're not going to be able to overcome the negative initial cash outflow. That's how the internal rate of return works. Now, before I go and tell you all the dangers of the internal rate of return any further, I do want to bring up that the internal rate of return is used quite frequently by businesses. NPV is more popular, and it is the one that is better. However, and I actually have seen this in practice on a number of occasions, companies will make, when they're doing their for projects that they're going to decide yes or no to, they have something called a hurdle rate. And where they get it, there's the big problem with this hurdle rate. The hurdle rate just comes out of their butts. I mean, they just say, well, our hurdle rate for projects is 9%. So they'll say hurdle rate, and this will be a company-wide policy. Hurdle rate's 9%. What they're saying is that any project with a net present value below 9%, I'm sorry, with an internal rate of return below 9%, reject. Any project that comes in with an internal rate of return above that 9%, you accept. Think of it this way. Here we have on the vertical axis of the net present value. So what they have done is they have established this hurdle rate, 1, 2, 3, 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%, 9%, 10%, 11%, 12%. And I'm going to mark these in, a few of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. So what they do is they set, by company policy, this hurdle rate of 9%. Right there. So they're saying that any project with an internal rate of return, you run the internal rate of return on the future expected cash flows versus the initial cash outflow, and suppose that you have a project that comes in with an internal rate of return of 8%. Project 1, internal rate of return is 8%. Project 2, the internal rate of return, let's say, is 13%. We would accept Project 2 and reject Project 1. Because according to their criterion, it's a single thing, a criterion. This project, if you discount it at 9%, it will have a negative NPV. This project, if you find its internal rate of return, if you were to use 9% for that project, it would have a very positive NPV. They just pull this hurdle rate out of thin air and they say, all right, any project that does not meet our hurdle rate for its internal rate of return, we reject. Any project that does meet our hurdle rate, we accept, or exceeds our hurdle rate, I should say. And again, the really big flaw on this, and I saw this over and over, I saw companies that had set an internal rate of return. In one case, they didn't even remember when they had set this hurdle rate. They didn't. I asked, well, when was that hurdle rate? Because interest rate environments change, you would have to move that thing around to reflect the current interest rate environment. They don't. They just sit there. Forever, we're just going to reject projects that don't return enough for our company's policy for what we do. The danger on that is there's another danger too, in the sense that once you have set in stone a hurdle rate, you are going to turn away projects that might very well be good projects, but they are relatively safe projects that have a lower internal rate of return than what you want. So in a sense, as a company matures, by leaving the hurdle rate in place, you are still exposing that company to the same risk profile it would have had earlier in its life. And that might not be the best idea for a company. Companies tend not to be as risky later on as they are in their early years. But if you've got a hurdle rate set in stone, well, you're going to be forcing that company to be as risky in the for current projects as it was when it was a new start. Just a caution, but the hurdle rate is out there, quite popular. It's used in combination with the internal rate of return. Other companies say, no, we use net present value for projects. We use net present value for projects. Now, there's another thing that can happen, too. In an ideal world, companies would be able to look at every possible project on Earth and decide which of those many they would take on and which they would turn away. Realistically, companies have sort of like a slate of projects. All right, these are the ones we're going to look at this year. And then they apply the net present value approach or the internal rate of return approach. Now, here's a problem, though. Suppose that they were presented with five projects, and all five of them came up positive NPV. Well, they should take them on. I mean, if their cost of capital is below what the marginal return on the project is, well, sure, you'll take on all five of them. If they're all positive NPV, there's an exception to that. And it's actually a real exception. You'll see it more than people think. It's when you have, let's say you had two projects, and both of the projects come up with positive NPV. By the very simplistic financial theory, we'd say yes to both of them. But what happens if they are mutually exclusive projects? If they are mutually exclusive, in other words, you can do one or you can do the other, but you can't do both. That happens. A couple of examples where one example that comes to my mind very right off the bat is a company had a substantial tract of land. And it had to decide whether it was going to build a factory to do one thing or something that was sort of like a factory, not exactly, to do the other thing. So it came up, both of the projects were positive net present value, very strong projects, good projects. But they would both have used the same piece of land. And under those conditions, they could take on only one of the two projects, period. That's all they could do. Now, they could have talked about buying another piece of land, but that would have changed the entire dynamic of the cash flows. Buying another piece of land would have skyrocketed the cost of either of the projects to do it. So they were going to have to make a decision, this one or this one. It's a very simple thing. They're both positive NPV. We should take them both on. But in a case where you have mutually exclusive projects, take on only the one that has the higher NPV, period. That's all there is to it. I mean, I went a long way around to say something that's kind of duh, but it can happen. And this isn't the same case. This was some years back. Company had two projects, and they were mutually exclusive, and they were both very good, and their NPVs were actually not that far apart. We're talking about millions of dollars in cash flow over a period of 15 years, and they were apart on NPV by maybe about 10 grand. And it was just killing them. Because for one thing, if they didn't take on whichever one of the projects, they were pretty darn sure that there was going to be a competitor who would take it on before they could get around to getting something else done, to getting that other project financed or do something else for that other project. So that was just a killer. Because it would just hurt. We have to throw one of these out, which is perfectly good. It is almost exactly as good as the other, but just a little bit under as far as NPV goes. So they had to say no. And sure enough, son of a dog, that other project showed up within 18 months in another company's asset portfolio. Killer, but you have to do it. If you've got mutual exclusive projects and you can't find a way to make them so they're not mutually exclusive, well, there you go. Painful thing. Now, I want to go back to this internal rate of return. It is used, hurdle rates are used with internal rates of return, but again, it has inside of it a mathematical quirk that makes it so that in finance, it is kind of complicated. You might want to think twice about using it. Dark, dark days. Let me see if I can bring you back to those ugly, dark days that were called high school. Okay. And specifically to that totally exciting, always interesting, just made you want to get up and before the sun came up and take a shower and go to school. Yes, we're talking about algebra. Okay. In that algebra class, I somewhere along the line, you guys are bright students, and you made it here to this good institution. So I know you saw this sometime in the past. You probably tried to wash it out of your minds. You probably saw it again in your math classes here at ISU. But do you remember polynomial equations, polynomials? And they factor this quadratic and all that. You'd have y equals x squared plus 5x plus 6. And you would say, all right, fine, then factoring that x plus 3 times x plus 2. And you would set it equal to 0. Because what that would mean is that you were making the y. You want to see on the y, my ass. You want to see where the y value was a 0. And with a second degree polynomial, you found two roots. Sometimes you didn't find any real roots. Sometimes you'd find one. Sometimes you'd have these parabolas that missed a little bit. Sometimes you'd find one that just touched. But then you'd also find those beauties that came down through and swept back up. God, that's the worst parabola I've ever drawn in my life. And those were called the roots of the equation. You remember that a second degree polynomial, one with the highest power being 2, has at most 2 roots. Could have 0 or 1. 0 if it doesn't even get to the axis. 1 if it nicks the axis and comes back up. 2 if it comes straight through and blasts back up. You're thinking, what the hell is this all about? And you remember that if it was a third degree polynomial, it could have 1, 2, or 3 roots. Oops. Here's a third degree, in other words, the highest power is 3, that has 3 roots. Here's, by the way, 1 that has 2 roots. And here's 1, by the way, that has only 1 root. I'm not going to drive you crazy with that, but that is relevant to the mathematical backdrop of internal rates of return. Now, as long as the internal rate of return has only 1 change of sign, it happens to be a first degree equation. It crosses the axis only once because it's a straight line. But if it has more than 1 cash flow switch, specifically if it goes like this one, negative to positive to negative to positive, that is 2. And the internal rate of return will have 2 values. Now, this would be a simple negative cash flow, then positive cash flows after that. This son of a dog right here would be negative cash flow, positive cash flow, negative cash flow. And the internal rate of return will have more than 1 answer. So when you'd key it into your calculator, you'd push it into your calculator, the calculator would give you the internal rate of return on that one. It would say, yep, here it is. But you wouldn't know which one it was, and it actually wouldn't matter because neither of them really means anything. But if it started searching down in here, it would find that one. But if in its little silicon brain it started looking up here, it would have found that one. Neither of them means anything, but the calculator is going to give you one of them like it's gospel. Hence, if you have a project where the cash flow switches sign more than once, the internal rate of return method fails. It's just, well, which one of these is right? Neither of them is right. They're just spurious. Hence why I personally don't use internal rate of return ever. But, I mean, look, this is actually a realistic thing. And I, companies will start a project. And then they'll go through milking it for money in its first phase. And then they'll go back into an R&D phase to improve the product after they've launched it, gotten product identity, brand loyalty, all that kind of stuff. Then they'll go and spend a buttload of money to make the product better or to make another generation of it. So you'll have a negative, you'll have the negative to start to get the project going. Then you'll sell some of the product for a couple of years, get people used to it, get it out there in the market and all that. But then, somewhere along the way, you will pour more money back into the project to upgrade it. And you'll have negative cash flow. Even though you might still be making positive cash flow off the existing product, you're going to come negative because you'll spend a lot of money to get the product to its next stage. And then it will recover and be positive net present value after that. It's not that uncommon to have that happen. And I'll even tell you, personally, in the when I first started my landscape photography company, I spent a load of money, I mean, right off the bat. And then I rode for a couple of years selling what I had in cheapo frames and all that. I built an inventory, sold in cheap frames, went to low-end art shows, all that kind of stuff. And I pulled in positive revenue for a couple of years. But then this year, I have poured in enough money to make me P-O-P-O. I am way negative on free cash flow because I'm now in these professional frames, museum glass. I'm paying the stupidly high fees at the real heavy shows where the nationally known artists are. So I'm negative now, and I hope to God that will be in a year or two I will be positive again. So you see, it really happens, and I can attest to that. This year, I'm so low on cash, I could play handball on the curb. So it happens. There was a method developed, and I'm going to warn you about this. There's a way with the internal rate of return to make this, the internal rate of return, not have this multiple values problem. But I warn you, you go on the interwebs or you get your hands on a couple of different finance textbooks and they'll show you different ways with different results even. They're not wildly off each other, but depending upon which modified internal rate of return method you use, you'll get a different answer. And like I said, it might be the difference between 12.92. As a matter of fact, there's a problem in your book that gives one way to do it. Interestingly, it's the way that I always did it. But then if you go to something like, I think Investopedia shows how to do an internal rate of return. You do it their way. And you get a slightly different, enough that Pearson system, which is so precious about exact answers, it'll say, oh, no. If I remember right, the book, I might be wrong about this. The example in the book was like, got a modified internal rate of return. It's called the MIRR of 12.92%. But if you do it by the method that is shown, I might be wrong, it might not have been Investopedia, you would get 13.05%. If you do it on Excel, you'll get 12.96%. So that's one of the things that is a problem with modified internal rate of return. Yes, it overcomes the problem of getting multiple IRRs, but it is somewhat sensitive to the method you use. So if you're going to use an MIRR, don't use it where even a tenth of a decimal place matters, seriously, on these. I'm going to show you the way that they do it in the book and that would be on your quizzes and tests. And it's also, again, the way that I learned how to do it years ago. And it's still, I swear, that's got Maybe it's not, maybe it never was the standard method, because I've seen now, by my count, four different ways to calculate a modified internal rate of return. But let me show you how, what I do here. I always feel like apologizing for this, because, I mean, there are all these different ways. The trick with this modified internal rate of return method is you're going to use a discount rate. You're going to need a discount rate to do it. And, you know, there's something about, well, if you've got a discount rate anyway, why aren't you using net present value, for God's sake? But that's neither here nor there for us. What you do is you bring all of the negative cash flows back to the present, and you take all of the positive cash flows out to the end of the project. Doesn't matter how many there are, you bring them all back. So in this case, I would have the negative $5,000 plus the present value of $1,000 discounted back two periods. And I'm just going to do that by hand. And for God's sake, someone do this with me. I'm so bad at math. I'm going to take $1,000 divided by 1.15 to the second power. And that should give me 1,000. Well, I'll do it times 1.15 y to the x 2 plus negative 700 plus negative $756.14, I think. Yes. And again, over here, the way I got that was I took the negative 1,000 over 1.1 plus 0.15 to the second. In other words, I just took a present value, the old lump sum way. Okay, you follow it? Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to haul this 2,500, which occurred in period one, and I'm going to pull that one out so that it sits with this one. So that on this side I have $4,500, which was the terminal cash flow, plus 2,500 compounded two periods. So I'm going to take 2,500 times 1.15 to the second power. That's $3,306. Is that right? Wow. $6.25. And that one I did by taking positive 2,500 times 1 plus 0.15 to the second power, because it came out, I took it out two periods so that it would match the period on the other one. So what I've got here at the end is at the beginning, $1,256.14. And here at the end, I have $7,806.25 positive. Yeah, go ahead. I just pulled that out of, I didn't write it. I was just to see if you would read my mind there, okay? And you failed to do so. Yeah, sorry about that. 50% discount rate. And that was my point before. You have to have a discount rate to do this. So if you've got a discount rate, why aren't you just using net present value to begin with? But no, we have to do modified internal rate of return on this son of a bitch. Now, I'll show you what's going to happen here. It's actually, this is cool. Notice that what we have done is we have turned a sign switching, a cash stream, cash flow stream, that switched signs twice to a cash flow stream that switched signs once. Because now what we actually, now what we can do is we can put that 0, 1, 2, 3, We can just put that into the calculator. At the beginning, you've got C0 is 1256.14. You got a 0 and a 0 for years 1 and 2, respectively. And at year 3, you got a positive 7806. Seriously? Positive 7806.25. Didn't mean for it to come out quite that pretty. Okay. And now, I'm just going to sit down instead. I want to show you. Watch. Okay, now, cash flow 0 is 1256. 5,000. Oh, there's the problem. 5. Cripe, I can't even add. I so suck. 5756.14. Negative 5756.14. Wow. Okay. Okay, so now I can do this right. The cash flow at the beginning is 5756.14 pos neg. Let's try that again. I'll do it this way. 5756.14. And then pos, make that a negative. Okay, enter that. Now we're going to go down. Cash flow 1 is 0. Enter. For one period, enter. Down, period 2 is a cash flow of 0. Enter. Down 1, frequency of 1. Actually, I could have done that with frequency of 2. I just noticed that. Enter. Down. And now we have 7806.25. 7806.25. Enter. Down. Frequency is 1. Compute. This is the modified internal rate of return, 10.69%. Got it? All you do is take the present value of the negative cash flows in the stream. So you put them all back to the present, add them up. You take the positive cash flows and you take those all to the ending year of the project using future values. And you add those up. And then you do a very simple internal rate of return. There's a negative for CF0, then everything is zeros along the way, CF1, CF2, however many there are, until the terminal year, where you put in that positive number from adding up all those future values. And then you say, find the internal rate of return. Again, though, there are other ways that you could see this done. And I'm almost sure there are a couple of profs in finance here, if you go on in finance, who would show you another way. That's because they're wrong. No. The deal, but now I'm going to tell you one last really weird twist on this. I know companies, I think they even mentioned this in the book. They use that 15% to discount the negatives and to take the futures out. They use the 15%. And then they find the internal rate of return and they compare it to the discount rate. In other words, they use the internal rate of return. And in that case, they're using the discount rate as their hurdle rate, their cost of capital. Now, let me repeat that, and then I'll ask you. They do this weird thing. They use the discount rate to bring the negative cash flows all to the present and add them up. They use that discount rate to take all the positive cash flows and take them all by future value to the last year of the project. And then they compute an internal rate of return that has only CF0 being the negative, and everything is zeros until the last year, when the last year you have a positive, that in this case cash flow 3, which is the positive number. Okay, here's what they do. They then look at their internal rate of return that they've gotten, this modified internal rate of return, their MIRR, and they compare that to the discount rate, treating the discount rate as a hurdle rate. I know, if that's fogging your mind, you just got to think about it. Listen to this podcast a couple of times and ignore my arithmetic mistake that I made over there, adding 5,700 and getting some bizarre. But anyway, now, again, after they've found the MIRR, they will say the discount rate we used at the beginning of this problem is our hurdle rate, our cost of capital, if you will, our marginal cost of capital. And then they'll say, all right, this project has a modified internal rate of return of 10.69%. The hurdle rate is the 15%. Are they going to accept or reject this project? Talk to me. If you get it wrong, don't sweat. I'll walk you through it. In other words, NPV on the vertical axis, discount rate on the horizontal axis. They are going to set 15%, their cost of capital, the discount rate that they use to start this whole mess off, as their hurdle rate. They come up with a modified internal rate of return of 10.69% on this project. Do they accept or do they reject? I know that it's almost like, God, it's... Exactly, they reject this project. Because using this modified internal rate of return... Remember, the internal rate of return is where the profile switches from positive to negative on the NPV. The modified internal rate of return we found was 10.69%, which means at their hurdle rate, that's a negative net present value project. That's a negative project. They would reject this project. You might see why I take a dim view of modified internal rate of return, but it is used. The idea there being, and again, step one, you discount, using present values, all of the future negative cash flows to the present and add them up. Step two, you then take all of the positive cash flows and compound them to the last year of the project using the future value. And then add them up. Step three, you calculate a standard internal rate of return with a negative cash flow at period zero. That's the sum of those negatives. Zeros all through the life of the project. And then a positive cash flow in the last year of the project, that is the sum of all the positives that you compounded out to the end of the project. That internal rate of return will be the modified MIRR, the modified internal rate of return. You can then compare that MIRR to the original discount rate you used to start the problem. If the MIRR is below that discount rate, reject. If the MIRR is above that discount rate, you accept. You know, in a way, this is kind of the hardest thing in this whole course. It's just it conceptually. And I'd love to tell you, just go out there and use NPVs. But you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to do whatever they tell you to do if you ever did this in the real world. Your company will have house rules. The house rules could be NPVs. The house rules could be IRRs. The house rules could be MIRRs. With hurdle rates, you might even work for a company that still uses payback method, the payback period method. You have to do whatever they tell you to do, and this is the most complicated and tedious of them. Honestly, I've been doing this for so many years, both in theory and in real life, that it's an interesting exercise, but I always use NPVs. It's just not worth the aggravation to do it another way. But now I'm going to take you outside of this and tell you about something else. There is another decision rule way. It's not NPV, it's not IRR, it's not payback. It's a very new thing that is showing up in high-tech, young, very savvy companies, and also in big industrial giants that can't do things except for the best way. And I can't tell you much about it. If you want to learn about it, I teach it in the terminal course here in finance, in a finance major, it's FIL 349. I teach at Summers. It's Advanced Financial Theory and Practice. It's a very new way that it has kind of like flavor of NPV in it, but it is essentially, you take it far enough and you realize that the 21st century is going to be something very different from what I'm teaching you in finance. Essentially, assets, equity, ownership really are kind of like myths, mythical things. We tell them to people to make people happy. Companies use it because it's a convenient model. Well, why did the sky rumble? Well, that's the thunder god. Well, it's not the thunder god, but it explains things. And it works, scares the shit out of the kids, and they behave themselves. Realistically, though, in this century, the big, massive multinational companies know that ownership, equity, stock, projects, assets are nothing but just one more derivative, an option or some other weird exotic instrument. That's all they are. And this method treats projects as options on the future. In fact, the one that I show in the 349 class is Boeing was one of the first companies that we documented using this new method where that uses options pricing theory. And I'll bring that up just slightly a little later in the course. But it's a very new world. And that, if you work for a company, a big, heavy industrial, maybe you'll see it. Work for a very high-tech company, maybe you'll see it. It won't have anything really to do with what I showed you here. Does it work better? Well, it's the new way to do it. Now I'm going to take you on one last journey on this, one last piece to kind of close this chapter off. The one deep problem with all of these methods that we are using here is that here is 0, 1,
2, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, /, and now let's take it out to 20 years, 21, 22, 23, /. Let's go out here to 40, 41, etc.
Forever.
All of these methods that are used and you are being taught have the danger in them that cash flows out here are almost meaningless to whether you accept or reject a project, because they discount so heavily by the time you get them back to here that they're meaningless. What does it mean to have $1 million, this project start generating $1 million in years 40 through 45? That means almost nothing by the time you've discounted that back to the here and now. In other words, in Western-style capitalist calculations, we discount long-term value in projects. We don't build a future. We build very close-in cash flows. If after 20 years I start killing people with my product, 40 years I start killing people with my product, who cares? That would be the cigarette companies. They knew damn well that they could not hold back the dam forever. But the problems would come so far in the future with negative cash flows and all that, and declining demographics for the sale of their cigarettes, that they didn't worry about it in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. They didn't have to worry about it because those future problems discounted back at such a low value. Bill Gates, when he started it, he and his crew started committing criminal acts in the 1980s. And went wild in the early 90s. They knew damn well that when the problems would come for them, they would already have acquired so much money that they could make those problems pretty much go away. They would have a near monopoly position. And any payoff, any fines and things like that they'd pay would be so far in the future that it wouldn't really impact their decisions in 1994, for example, when they decided to do a direct violation of the Clayton Act and essentially bully the computer manufacturers into dumping Netscape Navigator and putting Internet Explorer on the computers that were being built by Compaq and those companies at the time. The negative cash flows, the harm, the fines, all that, they would come so far in the future that discounting them back to 1993 would make them virtually irrelevant to the calculation. But you understand, there was a story some years back to show you the difference between philosophies of capitalism, philosophies of different market, of different economic organizations. One of the founders of communist China, the great founder, was Mao Zedong. In an interview, a brutal communist, Maoism and all that kind of stuff, many millions of people died under his brutality and all that. But he was asked about so you're opposed to this system of democracy, but the United States, it's been around for almost 200 years. Back then, this was while he was still alive and still quite cogent. The American democracy has been around for almost 200 years. What do you have to say to that? And Mao Zedong simply said, well, we'll see what happens. And what he was saying was, you have to look over hundreds of years. Referring, of course, to the fact that the dynasties of China have lasted many thousands of years. Another idea, to give you another perspective on this, was that the CEO of one of the Japanese auto manufacturers some years back when they were starting to flex their muscle and just beat the hell out of us in the auto manufacturing, in the auto markets. An interviewer, U.S. Financial kind of writer said to the CEO, okay, you make $300,000 a year. You drive a modest car and you eat with everyone else in your plant. You all eat together. You do the exercises everyone does every day. We would certainly not do it that way here. We pay our CEOs very well in this country. We have them separated from the workers because they should be above the workers. And the Japanese CEO just kind of grunted, and he said in Japanese, and the translator translated as best she could, he said, we build a good product. We will be here for many centuries. And, of course, let's count the number of... Where is, for example, Saturn now? Oh, it's gone. AMC, gone. Okay, who else is gone? Who else is dead? What is it? Pontiac's gone. All these car labels in the United States, gone. Dead. And yet that company, even though it's had some very difficult times, it will not die because they think much longer than we do. You keep that in mind. That's all I have for you. Thank you.